Let's find our way to the book of Ecclesiastes, just to the east of Proverbs that we covered last week. I shouldn't even say that, because if you were here last week, you know that coverage implies, you know, wholeness. And our study of Proverbs, I think we got up to about chapter 16, had 4 minutes left on the tape, and went, oh, there's a lot of good ones in the rest of it, too, and that was about it. I'm hoping we can spend enough time in Ecclesiastes tonight to where we have to do the same thing with Song of Solomon. And but we'll get to that book when we get to it. Ecclesiastes, that word comes from, I think it's Ecclesiasticus. It's the Septuagint's translation of the word for preacher, which shows up in verse 1 of chapter 1, the words of the preacher. And he refers to himself, the author refers to himself as the preacher several times. And so the Greek translation of that Hebrew word, it means preacher. So that's where we get that word. And that's where we get the title. This book, a lot of people misunderstand this book, and it is somewhat discouraging to read if you don't understand the proper perspective. You can go away, if you're not understanding the book, you can read the book and say, well, this is all about how life is pointless and empty and futile and horrible and meaningless. And why don't I just go jump off a bridge or something? Well, actually, what we're going to find out is that the book is talking about a life not centered on God is pointless and empty and meaningless, and it's just wind. So we'll jump into this. It says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Solomon never comes out and names himself in this book, but we find many places that point to this being Solomon, not the least of which he talks several times about being the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So that kind of narrows it down. And he starts out by saying vanity. Vanity is more than a piece of furniture in your dressing room, okay? Vanity literally means emptiness, vapor, and breath. It's just wind. It's just, it's vanity. It's emptiness. It's meaningless. I think, is it the NIV that says meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless? Well, here he says, vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. He says in verse 3, what advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? This is the voice of futility. This is, what advantage is there? I mean, have you ever been there? Have you ever gone to work and been so frustrated because it's just like, what am I doing this for? This is the same thing day in, day out, boring. Nothing I do seems to have any significance or value and or any advantage. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? By the time he gets to verse 8, he's saying, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done, so there is nothing new under the sun. It's a nice little rhyme there, the way it worked out in English. Well, in addition to futility that we saw when he's saying, what advantage does man have? We also see a total dissatisfaction. The eye is never satisfied. That you never, have you ever seen that one thing in life that you said, now I can die happy, and then found out that if you died 10 minutes later, you wouldn't be happy? That the eye is never satisfied. We always want to, that's why we keep buying the Guinness Book of World Records every year, isn't it? It's like when you were a kid, do you remember the world's fattest man buried in a coffin the size of a piano case? Well, every year, I'm not satisfied with that. I want to see if there's a fatter guy now. And there is, you know. And I won't say what his name is. And nor is the ear filled with hearing. You know, oh, if I could just get this one CD, my life would be satisfied. Well, none of us say that because we realize that there's nothing that we'll ever hear on this earth that will make us say, oh, now I'm satisfied. Now I can die happy. And boredom. You know, when your kids say, I'm bored, there's nothing to do. Or as in the case of our house, when your husband says, I'm bored, there's nothing to do. Well, guess what? That's what Solomon was at. Everything that has happened is going to happen again. Everything I do in my life, I've done before. Everything, there's nothing new. That which has been is that which will be. It's just futility and dissatisfaction and boredom. And that's a good description of life a lot of times. He says in verse 12, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. This was God's greatest nation, and this was the king of the greatest nation. This is a guy whose perspective is, I've risen to the top. I've gone beyond climbing the corporate ladder. I've been the CEO, and even further, I've achieved everything. Solomon has achieved everything, and as he goes on, he says, in verse 16, I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And so he's got all the college degrees there are. He's pursued all the scholastic degrees there could be and pursued all the intellect that he could possibly have, and he's not satisfied, obviously. Chapter 2, he says, I said to myself, well, come now, he's saying to himself, I will test you with pleasure, so enjoy yourself. And behold, it too was futility. So he realized, you know, I've been the king, and I wasn't satisfied. And I multiplied in wisdom and knowledge and intellect, and I wasn't satisfied. And so I thought, well, pleasure will satisfy me. If I have satisfaction, then I'll be satisfied, right? Well, Solomon, I think, was the original writer of the Rolling Stones song, I Can't Get Me No Satisfaction. That is a song that is just so completely right out of Ecclesiastes' mindset. And I try and I try and I can't get no satisfaction, that nothing seems to satisfy. So he says in verse 4, I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted them and all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. He's like, well, I went for the natural beauty. I went for the architectural beauty. I tried to accomplish things with the works of my hands. I designed these great buildings. I had them built. And still, no satisfaction. It's all futility. So he rose to the top. He was the king. Life is empty. Pursued intellect and wisdom. Life is empty. Pursued pleasure. Life is empty. Maybe if I leave my mark on the world with a big castle and do some forests and some nice waterfalls or something. Empty. And so then wealth. He says in verse 7, I bought male and female slaves. I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. Verse 9, he said, I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. So money, certainly, come on, we're Americans. We understand that if we get more money, we're going to be happy. We'll be satisfied. No. Take it from the guy who's been there. Solomon had untold wealth and riches, and he's saying this didn't satisfy. And the self-indulgent lifestyle that he lived, whether it was pleasure or money or anything, he says, all that my eyes desired, I didn't refuse them. Anything he saw, Solomon was the guy you'd want to go window shopping with because he had the money, and anything that you looked at and wanted, he'd buy it for you. But you'd soon find that was just as empty as he had found it to be. So he says, then I in verse 11, thus I considered all my activities, everything I had done, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind. All the pleasure, all the intellect, all the money, all the power and placement above everything rose to the top of the ladder and beyond. Had money, so much money you wouldn't know how to spend it in a lifetime. And it was all empty, vanity, emptiness, breath, vapor. It was pointless. It was striving after wind. Let's all go out. It was a bit breezy tonight. Why don't we go out and see if we can catch the wind? Well, of course you can't. That's what life is. when your pursuit is pleasure and money and power and accomplishments of look at what I built, look at what I own. And he says, he goes on in verse 16, saying that he realizes in the coming days, all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool alike die. And you can insert anything in there. The fat man and the skinny man are all going to die. The rich man and the poor man are all going to die. The handsome man and the ugly man, they're all going to die. What do they have in common? Well, they're all men. No, they're all, just saying if you're awake, they're all going to die. And so you have to remember what Jesus said, that the Father said to the man who accumulated riches for himself and said, "You fool, what, you know, you've done all this, you've gathered all this, but now tonight your life is required of you. So who's going to receive all that you've gathered up?" I caught this in the news about a week ago from the Associated Press on January 24th, so less than a week ago. Elwood, Indiana. Dateline, Associated Press, January 24th. A man who won $57,000 in an Indiana lottery game. You go, all right, that's my dream, right? That's why I buy those scratch-its, you might say. A man who won $57,000 in an Indiana lottery game died hours later when he was hit by a pickup truck. Carl D. Atwood won the money during the Hoosier Millionaire Thursday. "I am very thankful," he proclaimed. "I must admit that I never expected to be leaving the show with this amount of money. Now I can purchase a very nice car." Hours later, Atwood was hit by a truck as he walked to the grocery store where he bought the winning ticket near his home in Elwood, about 40 miles northeast of Indianapolis. He died in a hospital. Wealth. Is that what we want to pursue? If we just had $57,000, would that do it? Would that satisfy? No, because we're all going to die. And if we don't focus in on life after death, then this life is going to seem very boring and futile and empty and unsatisfying. That is the message of the entire book of Ecclesiastes. And Solomon says in verse 17, when he realized this, "So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after wind." Everything, whether it's trying to be famous, it's pointless because you're going to die anyway. Striving to be the richest guy, pointless because you're going to die anyway. Trying to have the most possessions, pointless because you're going to die anyway. And you'll find that when you attain these things, they are not the magic elixir that you are hoping they would be. Guys get rich and it becomes a huge headache. I don't know any happy rich guys. People become famous and they can't go anywhere, can they? The paparazzi are everywhere, and you realize that as they pursued fame and notoriety and celebrity, they become prisoners in their own homes because they can't even go to Burger King and buy a chocolate shake without people taking a bunch of pictures of them. And everything that they strove for now becomes the bane of their existence. No matter what it is, you strive to get, man, people work so hard and they forsake family and the Lord and everything, and they try to get that promotion or that position, and then it just consumes their life and they have no satisfaction. Oh, if I could get the Hummer or the big boat or whatever it might be that they're striving for, the toy that they want to possess. And it turns out to be a big headache because every time the thing needs an oil change, it costs you $200. And it just, you know, the dock fees are $300 a month, and it's just thing after thing, and you're never satisfied. You're never satisfied. And so Solomon said when he realizes this, "So I hated life." You thought that was a California thing. Oh, dude, you're hating life. No, that was a Solomon thing. So I hated life. Now, he says in verse 24, "There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? He's saying life, it's the simple things of life. Sitting down, having a meal, looking back on the day's work and saying, you know what? This stuff wouldn't even be enjoyable apart from the Lord. There is no enjoyment in life apart from the Lord. But if we recognize that even the simplest things, I went to work today, and I give thanks to God for that. I had a meal today, and I drank a Coke, and I'm happy because it's a gift from God. And all this enjoyment can only really be found in the Lord. That's the message here, that life can only be truly enjoyable with God. Now, chapter 3 begins a very famous passage that he says, you know, there's an appointed time for everything, and there's a time for every event under heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, and we just can't help but breaking into turn, 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 right? Was that the Yardbirds? Somebody who's over 30, tell me. The Birds, not the Yardbirds, just the Birds. Out in the yard. There we go. A time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. A time to search and a time to give up as lost. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear apart and a time to sew together. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. He asks the question, what profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. God has given us the task of discovering the appropriate action at the appropriate time. And if we realize that much of life is about, Lord, what would you have me do right now? What would be the righteous thing to do? What would be the good and proper thing to do? We will find a lot of enjoyment in life. Not from the big paycheck, not from the big boat or the big car or the big notoriety, but in fact from the little thing of, Lord, at this moment, what would be appropriate? What would be right for me to do? We're called to discern the right actions at the right time. He has set eternity also in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. You know what we find out from this? Is that God wants us to live minute by minute, making the proper choices, but he hasn't told us the end of the game. He hasn't told us the end of the story. How really dissatisfying life would become if we knew the end. No, eternity belongs to the Lord, and he's put eternity in our hearts, but he says, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done, that we're not supposed to be figuring out ahead of God. Right now, we trust that God is saying, this is the appropriate action. This is the appropriate moment. I want you to do this, and then let's move on to the next thing. Let's not worry about this other stuff. He's put eternity in our hearts so that we desire to be with him for eternity, but not knowing the end, not knowing how this whole life thing turns out. He says, I know that there is, in verse 12, I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor, it is the gift of God. This guy who has lived a life that should be ultimately satisfying by the definition of the American dream is saying, hey, it's the simple stuff. It's the, you know what? Let's have a meal. Let's have a cold glass of water or wine or whatever it might be and recognize this is the gift of God. And let's just do good in our lifetime. This is the purpose for which God has made us. We've got an eternal purpose and we just need to keep doing good and rejoicing until the end. So Oh, by the time he gets to verse 16, he says, "Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time for every matter and for every deed is there." Have you figured out that you can't figure out life? Have you figured out that when you see bad people suffer, and then you think, oh, if bad people suffer, that means good people are going to be blessed. But then you see good people suffer. You say, this doesn't seem right. And you try and make sense of this life. And what's even worse is when the good person suffers, but the bad person, you know, wins the lottery. I'm not saying poor Carl Atwood was a bad guy. But you see great things happen to wicked people. And you say, what's the story? That guy, you know, he's a loser. Well, eternally speaking, he probably is a loser. Because, and a pastor said this years ago, and I don't remember the pastor now, but I'll never forget the truth that was told. This earth is the closest thing to heaven those people are ever going to see. And that's pretty sad. Because they can win the lottery, they can be rich, they can become famous, they can get all this stuff that they think is going to satisfy them. And that's, they say, man, I'm in heaven on earth. Well, that's pretty sad, because the heaven that I'm expecting is a lot better than having a Humvee in the parking lot. Or Hummer, is that the same thing, a Hummer and a Humvee? I don't know. I don't know the difference between the birds and the yard birds, so don't ask me. And yet the righteous, when the righteous suffer, we realize that's the closest thing to hell they're ever going to see. And you know, that's not bad, because the worst suffering I've ever endured in my life, if that's the closest to hell I ever get, then I'm okay with that. Because ultimately, this earth is not fair and it's not just. How many times have we heard, hey, well, kid, life isn't fair? It's true, but eternity is fair. Eternity is just. He said, God's going to judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time for every matter and for every deed is there. Well, chapter 4 comes up, and about verse 9, well, not about verse 9, exactly, verse 9, Solomon says, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. The emptiness of life, when you begin to realize it, there is an inclination that many of us have when we realize this is futile, this is boring, this is pointless, this is empty, life just stinks. We have a tendency to want to withdraw, to become a loner, to be miserable in our existence and have a very solitude, a very oneness of existence. I'll never remember that word. Solitary existence, thank you, said two people. Well, here Solomon's pointing out that solitude makes weakness, but being united together, be it with a friend or a spouse or whoever this may be, having a partner is so much better, that two can accomplish more than twice as much as what one person can do. The two being better than one. Because if you fall down by yourself, there you go. I've tried it. You know, I've fallen down the stairs when no one's around. And cry as I might, nobody helps me. But when other people are around and I fall down the stairs, when I cry, they gather around me and laugh. And no, when you're not alone, you know, it's... You have this picture of me upside down on the stairs and everybody standing around going, ah! Maybe solitude ain't so bad. And so the importance there of being united, not living this solitude in your lifestyle when you realize that life can be very empty apart from the Lord. Chapter 5, guard your steps as you go to the house of God and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know they are doing evil. Hey, as you come to church, guard your steps. As you're coming to the house of God, draw near to listen. Come to church to hear. Don't just come to church to come to church. Because if you just come to church for ritual, because mom and dad make me come, or, well, because that's what you're supposed to do, because, you know, church on Sunday, I'm going to have to give an account for every Sunday I didn't go to church. Even Super Bowl Sundays. You're like, yes, we're here. Yes. Well, here's the deal. Offering the sacrifice of fools that they don't understand, that's just ritual. That's just going and, you know, here the priest will put communion in, on my tongue and I'll do this and I'll say that and I'll stand up when I'm told and I'll sit down. And what is that? That's the sacrifice of fools. They don't understand that which they're doing. But if you come to the house of God, as he says, and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools. In other words, come to church really to hear, to experience God rather than just, oh, I'm just going to come and do the ritual. He also makes an important point, verse 2, do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. For God is in heaven and you are on earth, therefore let your words be few. How quick we are at times to bring conflict before the Lord. Oh, that Lord, that person's done me wrong. You know, you should strike him down. You should judge him. Well, how often have we found out that we grossly misinterpreted what had really happened? That we brought to the Lord this conflict that should have never been a conflict at all. And the Lord here in his word reminding us that I'm seeing the whole picture. I see everything. So let your words be few. And I think it's funny because we sing that song, that worship song, you are God in heaven and here am I on earth. And so let my words be few. What God's really saying here is keep your mouth shut because you don't know as much as you think you know. And that's really what we should be focusing in on as we worship the Lord with that song. It's not, Lord, I'm speechless in your presence. It's, Lord, I really need to keep my mouth shut more often because I speak out of turn so frequently. And so we need to consider before we bring these conflicts to the Lord, we realize he knows the deal and our side of it usually isn't very accurate. Verse 10 of chapter 5, he says, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money. I think we were talking about this verse at lunch today, not knowing exactly where it was. Well, there it is. A large income never satisfies anybody. It never satisfies anybody. And that's what's so funny and twisted and sick at the same time about our pursuit of riches. A large income never satisfies anybody. It was the famous Rockefeller who was asked, how much money is enough? And his response, just a little more. Man, you know, some of us would kill to be in the position of having millions or billions of dollars. And yet, guess what? They're not satisfied. They're not satisfied. It is a pursuit which will never, ever satisfy. How much money? I mean, if we asked ourselves today, how much money would I be satisfied with? If my $20,000 a year turned and doubled and became $40,000 a year, would I be satisfied? Well, ask the people in the room that make $40,000 a year. No, need more. Okay, what if we double it, make $80,000 a year? Would I be satisfied? Some people say, oh man, I'd be satisfied with 80. No, you know what? Talk to your fellow churchgoers who make $80,000 a year. And they'll say, no, I still got money problems and still in debt. And well, let's double it. $160,000 a year. I don't know if any of us make $160,000 a year. We might have to go to another church to ask them. But if they were honest, they would not be able to say, you know what? I am satisfied. And double it. and double it and double it until you get to Bill Gates, the richest guy in the world, I think, at this point, and ask him, are you satisfied? And if he was honest before God, he would have to say no, because if he was satisfied, Windows upgrades would be free, right? It's the Antichrist. I'm just kidding. Sorry, Bill. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. It's just a simple fact. But you know what? We can go back down to that $20,000 or the $10,000 or the $2 and say, if you don't love money, you will be satisfied. Godliness with contentment is also a means of great gain, Paul told Timothy. Because those who love money and pursue riches, they pierce themselves through with many a pang. There is satisfaction in today's income if you don't love money. And then you don't have to make Bill Gates' amount. You don't have to make $160,000 or $80,000 or whatever it is. You can be satisfied with where you're at. And then you find that there's satisfaction in any dollar amount. If we have food and clothing, with these we shall be content. That's no income at all. That's just food and clothing, isn't it? He says in verse 15, as he had come, he's talking about, I guess I should give you the other part of verse 10, which is followed in verse 11. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. Have you noticed that every time you get a raise that you are expecting, man, finally I'll be able to live within my means, within my income now? Suddenly, we're living beyond our means again. How did that happen? You know, when you were making a little bit of money, you're driving the Hyundai, right? And then you made a little bit more money and you drove the Honda. And then you make a little bit more money and you're driving the Hummer. And it never stops. And as good things increase, those who consume them increase. Seems like, you know, how much money do we need? Just a little more, because I'm always living just beyond my means, we would say. Well, he goes on in verse 15, as he had come naked from his mother's womb, so he will return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. Translation, you can't take it with you. You were naked, I came out of my mother's womb, and I'm going to be buried and turn into dust, and I had nothing when I came out, and I'm going to have nothing when I go. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So what advantage to him who toils for the wind? What's the advantage of riches? Because you can't take it with you. There was that Christian bumper sticker that was popular for a while there about 10 years ago that said, I've never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul trailer or something like that. It showed a picture of a hearse with a U-Haul trailer, as if somehow you could take all your goods with you to the grave. Just doesn't happen. Well, chapter 6 goes on, a lot of futility, emptiness, vanity. Chapter 7, again, and some interesting insights from Solomon here. After a long life pursuing every pleasure, pursuing every means that he would hoped would satisfy him, and some of the wisdom that he got from experience was in chapter 7, verse 2. It is better to go to a house of mourning, that's with a U, as in sadness, better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. You know, tonight's Super Bowl parties will come and they'll go. And very few people's life perspective is going to be changed at the Super Bowl party tonight. Oh, they may be a little richer, a little poorer if they put a bet on the game. They may be a little fatter if they ate too many snacks. But as far as life adjustment, change of perspective, other than saying, well, I should have bet on the Panthers, that's about it. But you know, when I officiate a funeral, people analyze their lives. People get saved. People get refocused on, man, this is the end of life. And all of us are facing this. 10 out of 10 people surveyed die. They all do. And it's better to go to a house of mourning. A funeral will have more impact on your life than a house of feasting, than a party. It'll have impact because, you know what? That is the end of every man. The funeral, you see, the maybe that's why they have the open casket thing. That's the end of every man right there. And the living takes it to heart. When you realize this person is dead, and someday I'll be dead too, you'll take that to heart. Well, again, further on in chapter 7, verse 14, in the day of prosperity, be happy. But in the day of adversity, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other. This is something I've tried to communicate to people for years, and people don't seem to get it. And that is, we blame the devil for the bad stuff, and we give God the credit for the good stuff. But I believe the eyes of maturity see all of life as, God, this was allowed by you. We covered that in the book of Job quite thoroughly, that this life and the accidents that happen, as well as the blessings, the tragedies that occur, as well as the surprises, it's God ordained. It's God allowed. God knew these things would happen. He's allowed these things to happen to us as well as for us. And I think we need to take Job's attitude in this. Because when Job was rich and thoroughly blessed with possessions and family and everything, he's like, oh yeah, God is good. But when everything was wiped out and tragedy struck in every way that you can imagine, he still gave thanks to God. Do you remember that at the end of Job chapter 1? That he said those just incredibly impacting words, which was, he said, this is after all his kids have been killed and all of his possessions have been stolen or destroyed. He arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshiped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That's what Solomon's trying to communicate. When the Lord gives, we need to say, blessed be the name of the Lord. But when the Lord takes away, we also need to say, blessed be the name of the Lord. In the day of prosperity, be happy. But in the day of adversity, consider God has made the one as well as the other. Instead of walking around going, oh man, Satan's having a field day. Man, Satan's really attacking me. Oh, the devil this and the devil that. It's like, you know what? Yeah, life is really hard right now, but God gives and God takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Blessed be the name of the Lord. God gets credit for all of it. And it's credit. It's not blame. It's credit. Now, this is interesting. Verse 16. This is not something you would expect to read in the Bible. Do not be excessively righteous. And do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Now, a lot of people take this wrong. But if you read on, oh, like verse 20, indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. Also, don't take seriously all words which are spoken so that you will not hear your servant cursing you. For you also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. What does all this mean? Don't be excessively righteous. Don't be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Translation, hey, lighten up. Lighten up. If you don't, you'll become like the Pharisees. You'll be so overly righteous that you'll be ruined. That is not to say let's practice unrighteousness. It's let's not be hypocritical. in our pursuit of righteousness. Let's not be excessively righteous, because there's not a man on earth who continually does good and never sins. And if we're excessively righteous, we start thinking of ourselves as these sinless super saints. Jesus called them Pharisees. And we need to lighten up, because as he says, you know, if you take seriously every word which is spoken, and you don't take into account the fact that you've said some pretty dumb things too, then things that would be minor conflicts that you could just pass over and forgive, you never will. And it'll result in broken relationships, destroyed friendships, divorced marriages. It's like, you know what? Everybody has a bad day. And if you're not a legalist, if you're not a Pharisee, if you're not overly wise and excessively righteous to the point of ruining yourself, you'll realize, you know what? I'll use myself as an example. You'll say, you know what? Pastor Ron was having a bad day and he said something that offended me. And it was probably sinful, because in the multitude of words, sin is not lacking. And I talk a lot. And so it may have been genuinely sinful of me to say something and you got offended. Well, guess what? If you're overly righteous, or excessively righteous and overly wise, you won't cut me any slack. You'll consider that, oh, it's just like my servant was cursing me. Oh, that's it. I'm gone. That guy's the worst guy in the world. And I would say, lighten up, because you've said wrong things too. Don't be a Pharisee, because Pharisees end up surrounded by like-minded people. And they get into these sick contests of who can be more spiritual, who can be more righteous, who's got the most wisdom. And they're always finding fault with one another and breaking fellowship with one another. So I think Solomon's saying, lighten up. Let's lighten up. Let's have not a casual attitude towards God, but let's get a little more casual towards one another. Let's stop being so overly righteous and religious that we're judging everybody and contending with people because, frankly, your servant had a bad day and he said some bad stuff against you. Well, you can yell and scream and fire him because of his sin, or you can say, everybody's had a bad day. And frankly, I've cursed other people behind their backs too. So let's give one another a break, maybe. Well, chapter 8, verse 12. Although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear him openly. Here's the other deal. You could have, when I was just talking about the servant who curses your name, you might have thought, well, no, that guy deserves judgment. I'm going to fire him. I'm going to get in his face. Hey, guess what? Let him go 100 times. Let him sin 100 times, because, you know, a sinner could even do evil 100 times, and it may even lengthen his life. That guy's a liar and a cheat and a thief. But you know what? I know that God's going to judge. And I know that it's going to be well for the person who fears God. And so rather than being the sinner that thinks he's getting away with everything, I need to be the guy that walks in the fear of the Lord. Chapter 9. There is one fate. This is verse 2. There is one fate for the righteous and for the wicked. For the man who offers a sacrifice and for the one who does not sacrifice. As the good man is, so is the sinner. There's one fate for all men. Everybody's headed toward death. Everybody. For the one that goes to church and the one who doesn't. For the one who gets saved and the one who doesn't. For the one who walks in righteousness and the one who doesn't. We all have the same fate. We're all going to die. And we're all going to end up facing the Lord. And again, that is, we're all headed towards death. It's the message of Ecclesiastes. And if you stop at death, then Ecclesiastes is really discouraging, right? But it's about after death. It's about life after death. It's fear the Lord and be rewarded. Ultimately, and we've got to get on to Song of Solomon here. So ultimately, this is the conclusion of the book of Ecclesiastes at the end of chapter 12, verse 13. The conclusion when all has been heard is this. Fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. And that judgment seat that we stand before can be a judgment seat of condemnation, like if you get hauled before the judge. Or it can be a judgment seat of rewards, like the Olympic athletes who stand before the judges. It's up to us whether we desire good or evil, whether we live this life pursuing all these things that are ultimately emptiness anyway, or if we live this life moment by moment saying, I'm going to enjoy the moment, I'm going to rejoice in what God has brought me to right now, and I'm going to try and discern what is the appropriate action at this appropriate moment and walk in the fear of God. It's really the secret to life. Ecclesiastes, I think really, it's one of the hardest books of the Bible to understand, but when you finally grasp it like this, then you say, man, this has more of an impact on my view of life than just about anything I've ever read. Now, we'll go to the next book, Song of Solomon. The title in the Hebrew of this is actually the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. And that's why some of your Bibles call it the Song of Songs and some of your Bibles call it the Song of Solomon. It's the Song of Songs, meaning like if I said, this is the pizza of pizzas. I'm saying this is the world's greatest pizza. This is the pizza above all pizzas. The Song of Songs. It's basically saying this is the world's greatest song, which is Solomon's. As it appears that Solomon wrote this, and yet Solomon also stars in this. It's very much like an opera. As you read this back and forth between a man and a woman, you could picture this even being sung as an opera. It's very poetic. It's one of the poetical books of the scriptures. And we were praying earlier in the worship team room, and it was prayed for me that, Lord, please help Pastor Ron as he navigates this R-rated book. And if you've read this, you realize that, and maybe that's why you're here tonight, just to watch me turn red as I read this. Well, I'm not reading any of this stuff. There's kids present. The rabbis actually forbade this book to be studied until a man was 30 years old. I might be over 30, and the debate's still out on that, but I might be over 30. Not everybody is here. So parents, it's up to you as to whether, I'm just going to tell you the story and leave out the description of the body parts and what they're doing, okay? So essentially, there's this Cinderella kind of woman. She's either a Shumamite or she's called Shumamit. It's her name really isn't important. She's very much a Cinderella. It seems that her father has died and her mother has sons that I guess would be her stepbrothers that make her work, which a woman laboring in this day and age and what she expected out of life was very much different. And so chapter 1, look at verse 6. She's saying to this shepherd that she's met, "Do not stare at me because I am swarthy." This word literally means blackish. She's been out in the sun, and you know, it was not esteemed attractive for a woman to be very tan. Tan was not cool. You see, you're too tan means you're a laborer. You are a peasant, that you're someone who is so poor that you have to work in the fields. And so she says, "Don't stare at me because I'm blackish, for the sun has burned me. My mother's sons were angry with me." So it sounds like these are her stepbrothers. "My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me caretaker of the vineyards, but I have not taken care of my own vineyard." So she's so busy trying to meet the needs of the family and the stepbrothers are making her work that she's not able to look out after her own interests. But she says to this shepherd that she's met with, tell me, O you whom my soul loves. This is like a love at first sight kind of thing. Where do you pasture your flock? This is apparently a love at first sight, this Cinderella working, and she's embarrassed about her appearance, and yet she's got this love for this guy. Well, so she's like, you know, where do you work? And where do you pasture your flock? Well, as it turns out, this shepherd is King Solomon in disguise. That this is, and like we've read in so many fictional accounts of the king who wants to go see what the kingdom is like, and the prince and the pauper, you've heard this story of disguising himself and going out into the countryside and kind of experiencing life that's not based on the throne room surrounded by bodyguards and riches and everything else. So it seems like Solomon's disguised himself as a shepherd. The two meet and they fall in love. And he tells her in verse 8, well, if you yourself do not know, most beautiful among women. Notice that. He doesn't worry about the fact that she's been cooked by the sun here. He finds her very attractive. And if you read the rest of the book, he's like thinking she's very attractive. Go forth on the trail of the flock and pasture your young goats by the tents of the shepherd. So he's basically saying, oh, meet me there. Meet me over there. Ultimately, chapter 3, I've skipped a lot of details here. I'm keeping the story, but I'm skipping the descriptions. Chapter 3, I sought him, but I did not find him. I must arise now and go about the city. In the streets and in the squares, I must seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but did not find him. So this Cinderella story, it's very similar to Cinderella, isn't it? The evil stepbrothers making her work. And she meets this shepherd. She doesn't know it's the king. They fall in love. He says, oh, meet me there. But he's nowhere to be found. And so she's looking for him. She's desperately in love with this guy. She's looking for him everywhere. Can't find him. Well, then comes the day, verse 6. What is this coming up from the wilderness? Like columns of smoke perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all scented powders of the merchant. That obviously there's something big happening here, that off in the distance there seems to be this parade of sorts. It must be a very rich guy that they're burning all this perfume and ointment, and behold, it is the traveling couch of Solomon. 60 mighty men around it, of the mighty men of Israel. Well, it turns out he's coming. Hey, I'm gonna marry you. And so, oh, you say, oh, it's not sincere if I have to make you say it. Chapter 4, verse 7, he says, you are altogether beautiful, my darling, and there is no blemish in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. So it's the proposal. Hey, you know, you're self-conscious about your appearance. I think you're the most beautiful woman in the world. And here I've revealed myself, not as the shepherd in disguise, but as the king in this. Well, they end up getting, well, he describes in verse 9, for example, and I'm having to really skip a lot of stuff here for good reason. Verse 9, he says, you have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes. Guys, if you're ever in the doghouse, a bouquet of flowers, and Song of Solomon 4:9. Remember that. Okay. Would that work? Not if I have to make you do it. Okay. Okay. So, they get married. Wonderful thing. But here's now, like any good story, the dream sequence. Okay. It must be like the honeymoon night or something, and they're now sleeping, and and she's having this nightmare about when she couldn't find him. And so she's saying, the bride's dream here, I was asleep, but my heart was awake, she says in verse 2 of chapter 5. And she described, well, behold, my beloved had turned away and had gone. I searched for him, but I did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer me. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me. They struck me and wounded me. The guardsmen of the walls took away my shawl from me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, as to what you will tell him, for I am lovesick. So she's having this nightmare in this dream sequence of, you know, oh, I was having this nightmare that I, you know, he wasn't there and I was running around. And just like before when she was searching the cities, but now the watchmen, they find her and they're beating her up and they're stealing stuff from her. And she's desperately turning to the women of the city saying, can you help me find my beloved? Supposed to make you go, oh, not sincere. So anyway, she wakes up. Everything's okay. There he is. More descriptions. And ultimately, they decide to take a trip. And at the end of chapter 7, in verse 11, come, my beloved, let us go out into the country. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us rise early and go to the vineyards. So they're visiting the place where it all started, visiting the place where they met. And so, you know, that's the story of Song of Solomon. I got through it without saying any of those words that are in there that would make me blush and would make you go, Pastor Ron, just say what I think he said. And so everybody's happy. Let's pray.